From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. We've seen major medical advances in recent years. Most of those advances involve new treatments for disease. But what about cures? You'll learn how North Carolina could play a role in encouraging medical innovators to find more cures. It's been 10 years since the book Philanthrocapitalism documented links between business practices and charitable giving. The book's co-author discusses its continuing significance. You'll hear highlights from a recent public hearing featuring supporters and critics of North Carolina's current process for drawing a new congressional election map. And we'll delve into the most pressing concerns surrounding mental health in North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina lawmakers have gone home for the year, scheduled to return in January. Throughout the 2019 legislative session, the John Locke Foundation's outreach team, led by Senior Vice President Becky Gray, has been there defending freedoms, standing proudly for opportunity by helping state leaders understand how their choices will either expand or limit opportunity for every North Carolinian. That work, of course, has been going on for 30 years here at the John Locke Foundation, leading to all sorts of policy victories over those years and, in fact, throughout this one as well. Becky Gray is here to talk about what's been happening. Becky, welcome back to the
show.
Thanks,
Donna.
So we are entering our 30th year here at the John Locke Foundation. And over the years, there has really been a transformation of the state, particularly the last decade or so, so much of it grounded in research and work done here at the Locke Foundation. Give us the lay of the land.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the issues that we focused on, the things that we have identified are important core functions of government, and things that we've focused our work on for the last 30 years have been consistent during those 30 years. And we're talking about reining in the growth of government, lowering the tax burden, rolling back regulations on businesses and individuals. Also, better investments, smart investments in education, in infrastructure, in those kind of things. So that has been the theme of our work for all these 30 years. As you mentioned, in the last decade, there have been some real reforms along that that we have championed and
Lawmakers
have listened and have agreed with many of our recommendations, have taken those. I'm very proud. Our whole team at the Locke Foundation is very proud of that. And so as we move through this, what we're seeing is these are continuing. Those roots that we planted 30 years ago, the seedlings that began to blossom 10 years ago, we're really seeing those roots go deep and grow wide because these are policies that work. They work for North Carolinians. And so this session was a continuation of that. A lot of the reforms that we've had over the 30 years, the continuation, the strengthening of those, again, growing those roots deep and wide across all of our policy issues that we work on.
Now, over the years, and including this year as well at the legislature, really an effort to help lawmakers understand what they can do to help North Carolinians keep more of what they earn.
Right. Yeah. And that there's kind of two parts to that formula, Donna. One is allowing people to keep more of their money and recognizing that government absolutely has a function. There are core functions of government that we want to make sure that they are done well. But reining in that growth of government to function on the things that government should do and can do well and letting other things go. The other piece of that is how much money do you take in order to do that through your taxation system. So we've had a little bit of an unusual situation this session in that, you know, we still don't have a budget that has passed. The budget that the General Assembly put together, bipartisan support, by the way, that went over to the governor, continue to rein in the growth of government, continue to respect taxpayers, while really, I think, in my view, providing funds to do government well. As we know, the governor vetoed that budget in large part because it didn't increase teacher pay enough, and also did not expand Medicaid, which, by the way, has a $6 billion price tag on it. So you see, this year, I think that there was that clear divide between the governor's idea of how big government should be and the General Assembly's idea of reining in that growth of government.
There was some movement on the standard deduction, the zero tax bracket.
Right,
this
and
year.
This was the part of the tax package that went through this year, and we've had transformational tax reform in North Carolina, Donna, through the years. Big stuff happened middle of the 2013, I think, was the big tax package. But we've had other things that have pushed that along, refined that. As we see things are working, there are ways to do that. One was to continue to look at how we tax businesses and to make North Carolina a tax-friendly place for businesses, to come, to set up businesses, businesses here to expand. With the growth that we've had, that we've seen that really pays off. More people are working now. Less people are dependent on government. And then also a standard deduction that allows people to keep more of their money.
But we've also seen lawmakers really heed the Locke Foundation's recommendations to make sure that we are saving money, putting money aside.
Yes. And, Donna, that's such a big deal because we never had that before. Right now, today, North Carolina has about $2 billion in our savings account. It's about 10% of our state budget. It's the largest that it's ever been in history. And it's, you know, I don't like the I like having the savings account. But the reason why it's so important that we've had it, and we just can look very recently with these storms that have come through North Carolina, the recovery that we've had from that, the devastating storms in the eastern part of the state, as well as flooding and landslides and other things in the western part of the state. So this affects all across North Carolina. We've had that little bit of a cushion that we've been able to get money into communities right away. We've been able to help businesses get back on their feet, get the tourist industry back on their feet, get people back in their homes. It's been incredibly important to have that money.
Becky, you mentioned a moment ago Medicaid. You and your team have spent hours and hours talking to lawmakers about the fact that you don't have to expand Medicaid, and North Carolina has not. You don't have to do that to help people get access to affordable health insurance.
Well, and there's lots of other options, Donna. There's kind of two ways of looking at this health care problem, and I think that we can agree that, you know, health care has become so expensive. It is so expensive that it is prohibitive to many of folks in North Carolina. Well, how do you solve that problem? Roy Cooper believes that the way that you do that is you just have government pay for it and provide people with health insurance through Medicaid, which is really a broken, very fragile program right now. Or you can look at ways to reduce the cost of health care through things like removing certificate of need laws, through providing care through telemedicine and using technology to get health care into communities. And so people don't have to take off work necessarily to go for a doctor's visit. They can do that over their phone or their computer. Scope of practice. There's probably a dozen different things. None are the silver bullet, but together, when you if you're trying to solve the problem in a way that gives people more freedom and less government interference, there are ways to do that other than Medicaid expansion.
Regulatory reform, Becky. Once again, a multi-year effort, particularly over the last decade. But this year, we did see some really positive movement when it comes to the alcohol production industry, and also taking a look at rules and regulations and cutting some of those back.
Right. And that, you know, that's part of this formula that we've been looking at for 30 years and part of this successful formula that we've seen in the last 10 years. And it's rolling back regulations to allow people to work, to allow people to prosper, to allow people to start businesses, to allow people to enjoy their property. And we've seen that with continuation of a regular review of rules and determining, do we still need them? And as a matter of fact, with that process, we have rolled hundreds of thousands of rules completely off the book and opened up this craft beer industry by removing some of the regulations there to a whole new growing, burgeoning industry. Lots of jobs created.
And Becky, a relatively new effort for the Locke Foundation, criminal law reform. Taking a look at what is a crime in North Carolina, people would be surprised.
Well, it has been a new focus for the last several years, but certainly consistent with what we do. And that is looking for opportunities for people to grow, removing barriers. barriers that stand in the way of people being able to start businesses, to enjoy their life without the overburdensome of government. And one of those is criminal conviction. So we're looking at the over-criminalization in North Carolina and making it so regular folks can understand what crimes are so that we're not committing crimes unknowingly or crimes don't stand in the way of beginning a business.
Thank you so much, Becky.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Medicine has made great advances. It's possible today to treat many major diseases. But what about cures for those diseases? Our next guest has an interesting idea for helping to find cures. Jim Butler is Speaker Pro Tem of the Ohio State House of Representatives. He's visiting North Carolina to help promote his plan. Representative Butler, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you're here to talk about something called the Cure Bill. What's that all about?
So the Cure Bill, which is now a law in Ohio, is a multi-state compact that does exactly what you said in your introduction. It incentivizes the private sector to develop cures for diseases instead of just treatments. So right now, the way the system works, all the government money, which is $38 billion a year out of a little over $100 billion a year in total research and development, and all the money from charities, that goes into basic science research. That never is going to cure anything. It can help cure something by doing the basic research, but it never gets beyond animal studies. In order for anything to actually result in a cure that's approved by the FDA, the private sector comes and looks at all the basic science research generally and then picks out whatever's going to make them the most profit because they're businesses. But usually, almost always, that is a treatment that you have to take for a long period of time, even the rest of your life, and it's not something that's going you're going to take once or a short period of time and that you're never going to need again. For obvious reasons, that's not what they invest in because the return on investment isn't going to be there. So this bill, now law, multi-state compact, where other states need to pass it also for it to go into effect, we need six states, would provide that incentive for the private sector, not by spending a bunch of money. I'm not for doing that. All it is a pledge that whatever the states in the compact save for the first 5 years after a cure is found and widely available and everyone's cured, the inventor can get that money as a prize. And it would be so much money. I mean, healthcare is so expensive, as everybody knows, especially chronic diseases, that if you were to cure something like multiple sclerosis, you know, or breast cancer or diabetes or Alzheimer's, it's tens of billions of dollars. Even if only several states were to join the compact, that's how much the savings would be just over that 5 year period of time. So
this is law in Ohio now, and you need other states. So I imagine that's a main reason to be in North Carolina to see if we're interested.
That is correct. That's what I've been doing that for the past couple weeks, various conferences, visiting other states. But I'm going to try to get as many states as possible, because the more states that join the compact, the greater the savings, the 5 year savings would be. And therefore, the greater the prize, the higher the prize would be. And the more the private sector would do trial and error. I mean, that's the whole point. That's how things get invented. And we want to have the incentive sufficiently high So that the private sector, and including stock market, hedge funds, pharmaceutical companies, biotechs, everybody all around the world, they'll look at that basic science. They'll look at those cures in mice or rats that we see all the time for all these diseases and say, I'm going to take a risk on that, even if it's only, you know, a 1% chance that this might actually result in a cure, then it's worth my investment. It's worth my $5 million, which is the average price of a clinical trial, to go ahead and try it, because right now that's not there. And if it's there, and it's there all over the place for all these diseases, and the private sector funds hundreds or thousands of human clinical trials on the things that will potentially result in a cure that currently aren't being done now, in no time at all, many of the horrible diseases that are faced by all of us could be cured for real. I mean, we hear always elected officials saying, hey, we need to cure this or cure that. Well, what they do is they just appropriate more money and it goes into that basic science research, which is why we haven't had a cure for anything since polio. You know, that's over 50 or 60 years ago now. So that's the general concept, and I'm hopeful that this will spread across the country.
Representative Jim Butler is Speaker Pro Tem of the State House of Representatives in Ohio. On paper, sounds pretty good. If you've talked to people in healthcare or to entrepreneurs, what's been their response?
Overwhelmingly positive. So when you talk about starting with elected officials, the first thing we have to do is make sure that we're not spending taxpayer dollars on anything that potentially might work. And if we're doing that, then we have to weigh the advantages and disadvantages of spending that money. In this case, there is no spending of money. The taxpayers are completely protected, because unless there's a cure, then there's no payment. And unless the states actually save money once the cure is widely available, there's no payment. So if something unexpectedly comes up and the cure isn't working right, or it's not resulting in the savings that were projected, the taxpayers still only pay the difference between what they were paying to care for something like multiple sclerosis, and then now that there's been a cure, what they're paying. And they do that for that 5-year period by looking back every year for actual numbers. So there's no way in doing this that anyone can lose. We can only gain by doing this.
Hey, any pushback at all that, hey, we would love to see the cure, but then we're going to be taking a hit in our budget for a few years as we deal with this? Has anyone raised that at all?
Well, no, because that's not the case, because you don't take a hit in your budget. It's impossible to take a hit in your budget, because you're still going to only be spending what you would have been spending anyway for that first 5 years. So it's never a hit. And then after that 5 years is up, then you're saving the money. So you can only save, you can't spend more. And there's another part of this. So if somebody wants to claim the prize, then they give up the patent in exchange for the prize. The compact makes sure that they contract with a company to make sure, for manufacturing, distribution, licensure, and liability, that everyone gets the cure, so that it's widely available, everyone gets it. Because that's been a problem with some of these expensive treatments out there. So the compacting states get the cure at the cost, whatever the cost is. So it'd be pennies compared to what we currently pay for many different expensive treatments. Everybody else all over the world, states that aren't part of the compact, the federal government, who can join the compact if they want, which is a difference in some of the other multi-state compacts, and other countries, they also only pay the cost for the cure, but they also pay a royalty that's equal to their 5-year savings. It's only fair, right? So they have to pay their 5-year savings, but their 5-year savings is not part of the prize. The prize is only the compacting states, the states that have joined the compact, their 5-year savings. So it's extra money. That royalty money is extra money. That goes to pay for the expenses of the compact, but also most of it will go back to the states that joined the compact as a rebate. So instead of having to wait 5 years to save money for these states, then they could see savings immediately or after only 1 or 2 years. So it pays to be in the compact. Most of all, because it could save millions of lives. If even just one disease was cured, and, you know, 85% of all expenses for Medicaid, 75% for overall healthcare costs are chronic diseases. Imagine, you know, just curing one major disease, the impact that would have. And for me personally, both my parents passed away of cancer in their 50s, which is how 20 years ago I found out about the problem, because there wasn't anything once their cancer spread that might cure them. And I know many of your listeners out there face the same thing. That's where this started. So for me, the chance at no cost, at no risk to the taxpayers, of making a difference and curing these diseases, and saving so many millions and millions of lives and untold pain and suffering is well worth this.
Well, once again, it is called the Cure Bill. The person who you've been listening to who is pushing this is Representative Jim Butler, Speaker Pro Tem of the State House of Representatives of the state of Ohio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know, same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A decade has passed since Matthew Bishop co-wrote the book Philanthrocapitalism. In a recent speech at Duke University, Bishop discussed the book's continuing relevance in the world of philanthropic giving. Among his key points, many of today's philanthropists apply business principles to their charitable giving.
One of the things we talk a lot about in philanthrocapitalism is that one of the things that many of these new philanthropists are bringing to the philanthrocapitalists are bringing to the table is that they like to think about their philanthropy in a similar way that they think about their businesses. So they ask questions about what are we trying to achieve. How do we think the money is being invested effectively? What sort of outcomes are we hoping for? What return on our money are we getting? And I think it's easy to confuse that with saying we want to turn charities into businesses, which I think some of them do, but most of them don't want to do. But I think an investment mindset which says I'm going to view my donations as rigorously as I view my financial investments, I'm going to really ask, what's this money going to be used for? How's it going to be deployed? What am I expecting back from it? That just seems to me the definition of being responsible with your money. And investment language helps you think about that. Now, obviously, some investors do crazy things with their money, and so I'm not encouraging philanthropists to do that, although, you know, some of the people who've, like Soros, who have taken the biggest risk as investors also have taken very, very big risks as philanthropists and have been successful. I mean, I don't think, you know, any philanthropic advisor would have said to George Soros, yes, put a lot of money into the former Soviet Union and Soviet-controlled parts of Europe in the hope that you're going to bring down communism and produce liberal societies. But he did it, and it actually probably, you know, you probably say he made more of a contribution than many, many other people, diplomats, politicians, and the like, in bringing that down. So I actually still think that an investment framework is a good way to think about most of, you know, your long-term serious philanthropy. I think there's also should be a place for just discretionary, you know, emotional response philanthropy, but the investment framework is a good way to think about it.
That's Matthew Bishop, co-author of the 10-year-old book, Philanthrocapitalism. He discussed the book's continuing relevance today during a recent speech at Duke University. Bishop wrote the book while serving as U.S. business editor and New York bureau chief for The Economist. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. As state lawmakers recently redrew North Carolina's congressional map, they listened to public input about the map-making or redistricting process. Some comments dealt with the specifics of the proposed maps. Others highlighted more general concerns. Among those asking for a larger change to the redistricting process itself was Michelle Morrow of Cary.
I am a mother of five, and I often tell my children, trust is lost in miles and it's gained in inches. And unfortunately, whether it's you or your predecessors that have chosen the districting maps that don't follow normal boundaries, you've lost trust of the North Carolina citizens. And so I'm here today because I think this has been drawn out for long enough. I think there's a really simple solution, and all it's going to take is a map and a population census and a calculator. And it can probably be done in 2 days. And we're just going to divide people according to counties. And when you need more people or less people according to a county, let's divide them by the already set up city boundaries that are in existence. When a city needs to be divided because there's too many people that need to be represented, then let's use main thoroughfares. And if it's an east-west, let's use north and south communities on either side, and vice versa for north and south. What I want to say is, as public servants, we appreciate that you want to serve our communities, but there are so many more important things that are uniting about the people of North Carolina than this districting. It's taken way too long. We don't want to pay any more money. We don't want to pay outside sources to do it. We don't want the judges to do it. It can be done very simply, I think. And the other thing I want to say is it will be in your best interest to focus on things like healthcare and education and and responsible growth that is not putting an overburden on the citizens that already live in this state for those that want to move here and want to live here. I think you might even find that if you'll get this done in a nonpartisan way that is uniting and it's an equitable way, you might even find that the next election is the easiest one, and you don't have to protect your special interest groups and the deep pockets that you want to keep in your districts right now.
Nathan Click of Morrisville compared lawmakers fighting over redistricting to children.
When I catch my kids bickering with one another, they often want to tattle on each other. They tell me he started it or she did it. And from my observation, I see our elected leaders behaving much the same way. I've heard Republican leadership say things like, well, the Democrats did it to us, and so we're going to do it to them. Okay. To me, that's the same as saying, well, they started it, or it's their fault, it's not my fault. As a parent with my children and as a citizen of the state, I don't really care who started it. We just want it to stop, right? I think anybody that's babysat or has kids or even has nephews can relate to that. We just want the bickering to stop. The citizens of North Carolina shouldn't have to rely on the courts to address this issue. The Constitution gives the power of creating districts to the state legislature. We should have trust in the state legislature to accomplish this task that our founding fathers placed trust in you to do. We want this process to come to a fair and just resolution. We want a legislature that represents the people of North Carolina, that represents all parties fairly, that represents minority groups fairly, that represents gender groups fairly. We want a congressional delegation that represents the people of North Carolina fairly. We want our leaders to put their personal political ambitions aside. We want our leaders to put their political party interests aside and serve the state.
Elizabeth Sprocco of Durham urged lawmakers to use technology more when drawing election maps.
I'm here to talk to you about algorithms. We tend to think of algorithms as something that computers do, but it turns out that algorithms are just rules. Rules like minimizing county splits, minimizing VTD splits, minimizing municipality splits, not allowing for double traversals, maximizing compactness, and allowing for incumbency when it doesn't make a difference on those other things. All right, so people can draw maps using algorithms like this, but the problem with people is that when there are ties or when there's a conflict in the rules, we freak out, we fall apart, and we start violating rules. I would like to argue that computers do a much better job at drawing these maps, and that your job in the future, with the advancing of computers, with quantum computing, which is coming to fray right now as we speak, that your job is not going to be to draw the maps. Your job is going to be to decide upon the rules, to decide what happens when the rules are tied, result in a tied map. And I urge you to talk to experts. We have many of them in the triangle here who would gladly drive to Raleigh and sit here and talk to you about what kinds of rules make for the best maps, that make for fair maps, so that we can avoid another decade of issues and litigation.
Jay Delancey of the Voter Integrity Project questioned the entire process of changing North Carolina's election maps.
North Carolina is in a constitutional crisis, and here's why. For over 110 years, the Democrat Party used the redistricting process to dominate North Carolina politics. Then in 2010, the Republicans won control, and suddenly redistricting was magically transformed into gerrymandering. And Democrat front groups waged lawfare against the legislature. Activist judges played along with the power grab, and Republican gerrymandering was then declared racial gerrymandering. And the courts ordered more partisan maps. This governing body famously complied with that rule and said, okay, we'll give you more partisan maps. And just like Goldilocks, that same court said, oh, it's excessive partisan. Do we see what's going on here? After one last appeal of the Supreme Court, John Roberts made matters worse by declaring gerrymandering was not a federal issue. Well, he got it half right. He should have said it was not a judicial issue. You see, our founders used this document called the Constitution. They made gerrymandering a legislative process, and they did it for good reason. It's called accountability. A legislature that abuses their redistricting powers will eventually be voted out, either actually quickly be voted out in some cases, but the same cannot be said for judicial gerrymandering, or even worse, nonpartisan gerrymandering, like we see in California. You see, gerrymandering always involves Party A drawing the district lines to disadvantage Party B. And just like lemonade is lemony, gerrymandering is partisan by definition, and it is a legislative power.
Wayne Boyles of Pinehurst, a former aide to U.S. Senator Jesse Helms, echoed Delancey's concerns.
We should not be here today. It is not fair to our state and its citizens when the losing party, I don't care which party it is, who cannot be persuasive through the electoral ballot box, runs like little children to a federal or state judges, and in football terms, gets them to order our General Assembly to move the goalposts because they are dissatisfied with the outcome. The judicial fiat we have here is short-circuiting democracy. It smacks of pursuing power for power's sake. All public service here in the state and the nation is summed up in the King James, Matthew's Gospel 20:28. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. That's a servanthood established by our founders. Political power was never a consideration. This judicial fiat is providing subsidies for failed public policy decisions that have been rejected in democracy's marketplace.
You've been listening to recent public comments about North Carolina's process for redrawing the congressional election map. Regardless of any other court action, the state will have to go through the process again after getting new census data in 2020. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Mental health issues have become more of a focus, not only in society in general, but specifically in the discussion of health care policy. Turns out that at least one state, California, has experienced a big increase in emergency room visits, uses by people with mental health issues. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation, and he has begun to follow this trend and joins us now to talk about it. Jordan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You have been blogging recently about the issue of mental health. What really galvanized this in your mind that it rises to your radar screen?
Yeah. So, you know, I subscribe to a lot of healthcare newsletters that report on research and, you know, the general news of the day in healthcare. And so, you know, over the last year or so, I've noticed all these studies coming out about how mental health issues are on the rise, substance abuse issues are on the rise, behavioral health issues are on the rise, and particularly they're affecting younger folks, you know, high school age, college age, and the millennial generation in particular. And so it just is curious to me that this, you know, demographic of younger people was disproportionately affected by this. And so I started digging into it more and more, and it turns out there's starting to be, you know, a lot of interest in researching this topic. And really, we're just in the kind of data collection stage right now. But, you know, there's a wide body of research that shows that younger folks particularly are having higher rates of mental health issues.
That is so alarming and just disturbing
right.
and troubling for those people and what that could portend for their lives ahead,
right.
particularly if they don't get some sort of help. And
mm-hmm.
that, of course, is the intersection with healthcare policy, which we'll get to in
yeah.
a minute. But at this point, early on in the discussion and research on this, are there any thoughts as to what potentially is causing all of this anxiety and visits to hospitals?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that are, you know, trying to figure that out. But, you know, here's what we see. We see that, you know, insurance claims and hospital data will show us that, you know, emergency rooms are being more heavily used. And more often than not, it's a mental health or behavioral health issue. And then we also see among young people, that they're reporting higher levels of unhappiness than previous generations at the same time, and also more feelings of loneliness and isolation. And so, you know, that got me to wondering, and, you know, other researchers too, could social media, you know, things like that, cell phones be, you know, having some sort of cause? And, you know, looking into the research further, there's psychological studies that are done that show links between higher uses of cell phones and screen time with higher rates of loneliness and, you know, lack of self-confidence and things like that. So, you know, while there's not a direct link, I think there's really something there that, you know, as kids are sacrificing more face-to-face time with family, friends, neighbors, and replacing that with screen time, you know, there's an effect going on there. And, you know, I think we're starting to see it play out a little bit with some of the insurance claims data, where high school students and college students year over year are going up 300-400% of the amount of claims going towards this.
That is so counterintuitive, at least in my mind, Jordan, because now we are literally connected to the world, connected mm-hmm. to pretty much anybody we want to be connected to, right in the palm of our hands
yep.
with our cell phone. And particularly on social media, if you follow people, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, their lives look really happy and
That's right.
active, and that everything is going great. And I kind of wonder, not based in research, because I'm not a researcher like you mm-hmm. are, but if we've set up a false expectation for people.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's it. And yeah, once again, this is more so my opinion based off what I've seen. But I think that, you know, what happens is with so much access to other people's lives and information and everything, it becomes sort of a comparison game, and people are spending so much time online because, you know, it's general human nature. We want to feel like we belong to something. We want to be a part of something. And so sometimes social media can be that belonging, be that place where you can be involved, but that's not real life. And so I think, you know, kids, younger kids may get caught up in this, well, this is real life, but it's not. And so I think that's certainly one of the trends. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really important in this conversation, a researcher named Robert Putnam wrote a book about this idea of social capital, you know, the societal trust, the societal fabric that keeps us together, interactions with people that are different than us, but we can trust them. And so, you know, the less time we spend with our neighbors and communities, the less trust there is, the more isolation, and that can lead to these behavioral health problems that we see. So I think, you know, they're all interconnected, but really nailing down everything is going to be a tall task for researchers in the future.
Not only troubling for the individuals who are having these episodes where they feel like they need to seek professional help, but from a policy perspective, Jordan, this has got to be having an impact on the utilization
yep.
of medical care.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that takes us to the issue of cost.
Yeah.
Are we seeing any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll take a while till, you know, the full cost is borne out. But what we see now is, like you referenced in California, the emergency department use for youths with mental or behavioral health problems is just skyrocketing. And so, you know, the emergency room is the most expensive place to receive care. And a lot of times, you know, the people will go for a panic attack or, you know, it's not something mild, but something that probably doesn't need an emergency room visit. And, you know, we eventually all pay for that in our premiums and everything, all of the healthcare spending. So while we see that, you know, individuals are going to the emergency room with more instances of people either attempting suicide or successful at suicide. You know, these are all have implications for, like you said, the utilization, and especially in the most expensive place, the emergency room. And you know, a lot of times we see people kind of almost emergency room surfing, for lack of a better term. They just keep bouncing around because they can't really find the help they need, because a lot of times the emergency rooms, there's nothing really to diagnose other than you're having a panic attack or something like that. And so, yeah, it's a real problem.
I can remember growing up, my mom had this saying, if there's no blood or no bones, you don't go
That's right.
to the emergency room.
I think we had a similar term. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. But ironically, Jordan, the potential source of at least part of this problem, the phone in the palm of the hand, could also be a potential help for people. Talk to us a little bit about telemedicine.
That's right. And so, you know, telemedicine is really filled the void where, you know, some of these people may think they can't get help. You know, connecting someone via your telephone or cell phone with a mental health professional, whether that be in your state or out of state. But, you know, that offers that level of personalization. And, you know, some people may feel shamed or embarrassed to go to and admit they have some sort of problem. So, you know, telemedicine is really, it can really, you know, have the potential to help solve a lot of these issues by just connecting people more in a more personalized and comfortable manner to try to address the problems rather
than in a less costly manner as well.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, and that's the most important thing is when these issues start flaring up is to get these people who are suffering from mental health issues and get them help in front of a professional to try to, you know, tamp down on these before they become bigger issues down the line.
Well, unfortunately, it has become a bigger and bigger issue. It has become. And Jordan Roberts, though, is starting to blog about that, write about that, and take a look at some of the growing body of research in this area of mental health, particularly with young people. Jordan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.